This is Junk Food Cinema.
Everybody get up, it's time to slam now. We got a real jam going down. Welcome to the Space Jam. Space Jam. Here's your chance, do your dance at the Space Jam. All right.
Everybody get up. It is in fact time to slam now, and we've got the real jam going down. Welcome to Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good it just weekly. Has to be fattening. What did I
weekly.
Say?
Weekly.
Weekly in quotation marks. Don't worry about it.
We used to be weekly.
Weeklish. Weeklish.
Week-like in nature?
Week adjacent. Weekly adjacent podcast here on FilmSchoolRejects.com that you can follow on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. And you can get us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. If you go to iTunes, please rate and review us. That really does help us move up those ranks. We would appreciate that very much. I'm Brian Salisbury. I'm your host. You guys probably know this. We've been off for a couple weeks and I've already forgotten how the intro to this show goes. So let me try it this way. And now, your starting lineup for Junk Food Cinema. Standing 6 foot something from the depths of hell and all points south, you know him as a screenwriter, also starting novelist, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Ready for this?
I think we are ready for this. And starting center.
We're keeping going.
From the School of Hard Knocks and the University of Hard Pretzels, he is Brian Salisbury. Hello, that's me. I'm really excited for today's episode.
Yeah, you are.
Because this is one of those moments where we're covering a movie that I feel like I'm going to be apologizing for a lot as we talk about it, because I am very aware that a lot of my love for this movie is steeped in nostalgia, steeped in what I was into and what excited me, and what excited 12-year-old Brian when this movie hit theaters in 1996.
Yeah, kind of like half of the films we fucking talk about on this show.
Yeah, but it struck me as we revisited it tonight that, like, this is one of those cases where this show really lives up to its name, because watching this movie, I was like, oh, this is not good. This movie is is not a good movie. But I love the hell out of it, and there's just nothing I can do about it. I could recognize all of its flaws from Space.
Yeah.
Jam. But it still just, like, delights me to no end. And that, of course, is Space Jam from 1996.
When the world's greatest athlete, Michael Jordan, teams up with the world's best-loved cartoon character, Bugs Bunny, you won't believe your eyes.
What's going on here?
We need your help!
Warner Brothers presents Jordan,
Bugs
Bunny,
Special Delivery.
Together, they just might save the world. Space Jam. You've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, Space Jam's an odd little...
It's so weird that this movie exists.
It's an odd little Daffy Duck of a movie. Yeah, no, not only that it exists, but how it exists.
Yeah.
The state it exists in. It's such a weird little blip in the pop culture, in such an odd time that the movie just comes out weird. It's a Looney Tunes movie,
mm-hmm.
in which the Looney Tunes are the supporting cast.
Yeah, it's like, and also starring the Looney Tunes in this Looney Tunes movie.
Yeah, like you almost feel like, Bill Murray...
Yeah.
Who is barely in this movie is more of a character than most of the Looney Tunes in this movie. He probably has a little less screen time than Bugs Bunny.
And yet is billed after rookie sensation Sean Bradley in the credits, which is, by the way, one of the most unintentionally hilarious things that has ever been said in a movie are the words rookie sensation Sean Bradley. But yeah, this movie, okay, first of all, I feel like we have accidentally created a running theme in the last few episodes, because we did a movie based on a video game.
Yeah.
Then we did a movie based on a board game.
Yeah.
This is a movie apparently based on two completely different series of commercials, which is a really bizarre thing. There were two different series of commercials going on. One was, at the time, before, like right as this movie was being incepted, the first was Bill Murray doing this series of ads for the NBA where he was retiring from comedy to pursue a career in the NBA. And the joke was at every press conference, people were just like, why are you doing this? Like, what? Why do you think you could play in the NBA? And he's just like, well, I've achieved the height of my current field, and I think it's time for me to try another. And they're like, oh, so you won an Oscar? And he goes, no, I didn't win an Oscar. And they're like, oh, but you were nominated. No, I wasn't nominated. So it's really just him poking fun at himself. And the other series of commercials apparently had Michael Jordan, I think, playing against, I'm trying to remember the specifics of it, playing against like Marvin the Martian. So there were like two different series of commercials that were going on that inspired this particular movie. So this is a movie based on two different ad campaigns. This is like Don Draper produces a movie.
Yeah, and it kind of feels that way to a certain extent. Like It's a weird fucking movie. Like, this is, I forgot how weird it was. Like, when it came out, I wasn't a big fan of it, but it was one of those movies that kind of grew on me, because I was just a little too old when this came out to really appreciate it, and not old enough to be able to go back and truly be nostalgic at that point. So I was just in that window where it was just not right for me. But then I watched it later and got an appreciation for it. But watching it again tonight, and breaking it down and just seeing how it plays, it's such a strangely structured thing.
Mm-hmm.
With by the way, wonderful moments. Like, there's some really, really great stuff in here, which is why it is so beloved and why it has that kind of reputation in the same way that Mortal Kombat does, where people are like, yeah, it's not good,
but
it's entertaining. And it is, like, you know, I think every movie should have Bill Murray show up in the third act and go, I think I could be of assistance.
Yes.
I don't care what kind of movie, romantic comedy, he shows up to the romantic lead and helps her or him out. Try to defuse a bomb, Bill Murray shows up. Bill Murray knows which wire to cut and has some jokes to boot. You know, I don't care. Civil War. Why was he not in Civil War? Where was Bill Murray showing up to be on Team Cap and be, I believe I could be of assistance, and then, you know, beats the crap out of Iron Man. Why was that not a thing?
This is interesting. And the way he sneaks around and just shows up places unannounced, he could be on every film set of every production and no one would know.
Oh yeah, you'd never know. You don't know if Bill Murray's there. He may just do what he did here in Austin and just kind of show up and walk behind the bar. And
he's the new Candyman. I mean, basically, if you say his name three times, he kind of just shows up. So. And we might get
Bill
him on the
Murray.
We might get him on, well, I know, which makes that Jarmusch movie even crazier if you think about it.
Coffee and cigarettes.
Because they say his name
about.
Like 50 times in that movie.
Yeah, and he just shows up and he's serving coffee. Because he's Bill Murray.
For those of you who aren't aware, Space Jam is a film in which aliens come down from a place called Moron Mountain, which is a planet / amusement park. And these aliens have been sent by their boss, Mr. Swackhammer,
who sounds an awful lot like Danny DeVito.
The tallest character Danny DeVito has ever played. Are sent down to collect the Looney Tunes to be the latest attraction at Moron Mountain because their gate receipts have started to dip and they need something to get people, get butts in seats. So they decide that they're going to enslave the Looney Tunes. Well, so Bugs Bunny, quick thinking as always, manages to convince them that the Looney Tunes should be afforded the chance to defend themselves before being enslaved in an arena of their choosing, and they take one look at these diminutive little aliens and decide, oh, the arena we're going to choose is basketball. Well, wouldn't you know it, these aliens happen to have the ability to turn into the mood slime from Ghostbusters 2, crawl into professional NBA athletes, and steal their talent, thus becoming giant, absurdly talented monstars who present an issue. Now, for the Looney Tunes to win the game, they have to kidnap and enlist the services of one retired Michael Jordan. that is our movie, essentially.
Who,
from
by
start
the way,
to
doesn't have his power stolen because he's not a basketball player. He's
right.
now a baseball player.
This is kind of the important thing to talk about with this movie. The thing that I still love to this day that attracted me to it initially as a 12-year-old kid. Actually, I think it was 11 when this came out because it came out in the summer. That attracted me to it as a kid that still makes it enjoyable for me as an adult is that it exists in this it's a weird time capsule of the time that Michael Jordan first retired from basketball, because he did it twice.
Yeah.
And came back. No, actually, technically, he did it three times because he came back twice. So the first time Michael Jordan retired and decided he wanted to play baseball, that's where this movie takes place. So this movie takes place after he's retired from the Chicago Bulls. I believe they had won five championships at the time. He came back and they won another one. But he decided to play baseball. He was with the Barons, which was a Chicago White Sox affiliate farm team, and not doing so well. And the one thing I do appreciate about Michael Jordan in this movie is that he's willing to poke fun at himself a little bit.
He takes it on the chin.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
even a god can bleed, and that's really what this movie is going for.
Yeah, it's a very much a film about how big a mistake it was for him to be like, I'm going to go in and dominate in baseball. Like it is very much him publicly kind of coming out and doing that and really giving himself over to the fact that he belongs in one sport and that's where he should be. And in the movie, the sportscasters are making fun of him.
Actual sportscasters like Jim Rome and I believe it is one of the Gumbels. Is it Bryant Gumbel? It might be Bryant Gumbel. It's one of the Gumbels. Anyway, yes, real sportscasters.
Yeah, yeah, are mocking his inability to play baseball.
Yes, I believe Jim Rome says he has an anemic batting average, which I thought was quite good.
Yeah, and it's he really does kind of own up to the fact that this is not what he's supposed to be doing, and it's crazy. For those of you that don't know, this really was a thing that happened.
Yeah.
It really was a thing that baffled the shit out of all of us.
It's Ahmad Rashad, by the way. Sorry, it's not a Gumbel. It's Ahmad Rashad. Anyway.
It was, it's like, why would somebody at the peak of his game just up and leave and then go try another sport? Like, why would you do that? Like, it was almost, it felt like it was a reaction to Bo. Bo Jackson, who, for those of you that aren't familiar, was both a baseball player and a football player and would go back season to season between teams and was a big star for quite some time in the 90s. And so it felt like it was a reaction to that. Like, well, I can do that. I've been I'm not just the top of one game. I could be the top of two. And it just never happened. And so his apology was to make a kid's movie making fun of himself where he then plays basketball against aliens.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of those really weird, like, this is a nexus of young Brian Geekdom, because at this time I was obsessed with Looney Tunes. It was on every day when I got home from school. On like Nickelodeon basically like built its brand off the backs of the Looney Tunes. They showed so many reruns of Looney Tunes. It was crazy.
Well, in the 90s, there was a resurgence in love for the Looney Tunes, and there was a big pop culture blast with it. Like it was so weird to be reminded of it watching this movie that 20 years ago, the Tasmanian Devil was everywhere.
Yeah, it's
like,
true.
And he was one of the most popular Looney Tunes characters. He was on T-shirts and sweatshirts and backpacks and everything all over the place. And and there was a weird kind of hip hop crossover with that, with the characters at the time. That was just really, really weird. But yeah, the Looney Tunes was huge.
Yeah.
You know, and in this era, this is the era where we saw Tiny Toons come back or appear. And then after that, Animaniacs. And we saw kind of a push towards merging adult and child animation again for a while, which leads to this, which has a couple of weird, we're just now hitting this movie came out when we were just hitting the point where people were like, oh, you know what adults like in kids' movies? References that they get.
Yeah.
And there's like an afterthought one in here that's in there that you're just like, what the fuck is this doing in a kids' movie?
Yeah. Oh, I know exactly which reference you're referring
to. Yeah. There's a moment where Yosemite Sam and
I think it's Elmer Fudd
and Elmer Fudd are dressed up as the
Jules and Vincent.
Yeah, from Pulp Fiction, and start shooting one of the Monstars, and it just happens.
And it even plays Miserlou as they do it.
Yeah, and it's such a weird like. The cut, the edit there is like so sloppy that it's almost like it felt like someone's like, I've got an idea for a joke. We can cram it right in here.
Yeah.
And it doesn't fit. And it's just so weird. And I'd completely forgotten that this joke existed. And I'm just like, why would you put that in a kid's movie? Like that's absurd. But at the same time, it's also part of this movie's charm because this movie really takes off when the basketball game starts.
Yeah.
But it really, really takes off in the second half of the basketball game when the Looney Tunes remember, oh shit, we're the Looney Tunes. We should totally be doing all this stuff we should have been doing the whole time. We are the Harlem Globetrotters. And so they start playing like the Harlem Globetrotters. And it's really, and that's where this movie, all of it, this movie's great moments come from that second half of the game.
Yeah. And the other half of this for me as a kid was that this was also the time when I was most into basketball. This was the time when like Reggie Miller was playing with the Pacers. I lived in Indianapolis. The Pacers were amazing. They were a fantastic basketball team. Reggie Miller was then, I think, as Steph Curry is now. He was one of these guys that was just phenomenal to watch. King of the three-point shot, and this was one summer removed. The release of this movie is one summer removed from the summer in which Reggie Miller scored 8 points in 8.9 seconds against the Knicks in the Eastern Conference semis. Like, it is still, like, to this day studied as, like, no one really understands how he pulled off scoring 8 points in 8.9 seconds by himself. Like, it might as well have been very much like a Bugs Bunny cartoon from like the old days with baseball, where it was like playing center Reggie Miller, playing forward Reggie Miller, playing guard Reggie Miller, because he was basically doing the whole thing himself. So I was like really into the Charlotte Hornets. So the like they were like, as much as I love the Pacers, I think my favorite team was probably the Charlotte Hornets because I thought their mascot was cool. I was a big fan of the big three of Alonzo Mourning, Larry Johnson, and Muggsy Bogues, two of which are in this fucking movie. Yeah. So like this was just a perfect nerd nexus for me. I was like, this is everything I ever wanted to see in a movie. Michael Jordan, who is amazing to watch as a player, and I remember when he retired, like being like really sad as a kid because he was just so much fun to watch.
Oh yeah.
And then on top of that, you had the Looney Tunes, and it was like a kid's movie, and it's the summer. I was so excited to see it. I loved every second of it. And as I watch it now as an adult, I realize that one of the worst things that you could possibly do if you want to give your movie a shelf life is put current athletes in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Because the thing about the careers of athletes is that they have really one of two trajectories. You could be a Hall of Famer like Michael Jordan, who, like, this movie absolutely... Like, they lose nothing, you know, in hindsight by having Michael Jordan, the star of this movie, is every bit the all-star now, the legend now that he was then. Then you have players like Sean Bradley, who was a rookie sensation, but then for the rest of his career was like one of the most inconsistent players, got bounced around to a bunch of different teams, and was only ever really good at blocking shots because he was 7'6" tall. So there's a lot of things about this movie that I feel like date it impossibly, and it's fun to watch, I think, as a time capsule and just remember. Like, there's a line that Charles Barkley has when he's lost his powers and he's in church and he's praying to God to give him his basketball abilities back, and says, I'll never go out with Madonna again, because, you know, that big news story about Charles Barkley having a brief fling with Madonna, because she had flings with, I think, three or four different NBA players at the time.
Oh yeah, the most notorious
Rodman.
Yeah, being Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And everybody thought that Charles Barkley was making a reference to that, forgetting the fact that Barkley also had a fling with Madonna. So even at the time, that joke was lost on some people.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of bits in here that you really have to kind of know your history. See, it's funny because, see, this was at the era that I was big into basketball, because I was big into basketball when I was younger.
I was actually, I'll say this, man. I was surprised how excited you were to cover this movie.
Because when I...
Because I don't really think of you as a sports guy, at least now.
I mean, I enjoy sports and I watch sports every once in a while, but, you know, when you start doing a ton of things, you know, something falls by the wayside, and for me, it was sports. But when I grew up, sports was something I was very much into, especially basketball. When I lived in... I was a military brat, and I lived in Tucson, Arizona for several years. And I lived there in Tucson, Arizona in the late 80s. So some of you basketball fans right now, there's probably three or four of you going, wait. For the rest of you, you're like, okay, Arizona, the University of Arizona is there, the Bobcats, the Wildcats. At the time, there were two star players on the team. One was a young rookie, and one was the experienced senior. The young rookie was a guy named Sean Elliott. Who would graduate as, you know, one of the big stars of the Wildcats, and then get drafted by the Spurs during the same year as David Robinson, which oddly enough would be the same year that my dad would get transferred to San Antonio. So I watched Sean Elliott play in college, and then the same year moved over and started watching him as a pro. So of course, instantly I'm a Spurs fan, because I'm not a Spurs fan, and I'm not a fan of whatever city I'm in. I'm a fan of Sean Elliott. So if Sean Elliott's a Spur, I'm a Spurs fan. And the senior player who was playing with Sean Elliott at the time was a gentleman named Steve Kerr.
Yes.
Who of course would be play for the Bulls alongside Jordan. And then would currently be
kicking ass with the Golden State Warriors.
The Golden State Warriors, yeah. which I hear may have broken the Bulls record for greatest team ever.
Yeah, for greatest single season record. Steph Curry is the only, he just won MVP. He's the only unanimous selection ever.
Yeah.
So Steve Kerr's done pretty well as a coach, I feel
like his whole career, like he did great in college,
yeah.
He did great on the team, because he was one of those guys that bounced around at first as well. Like,
yep.
I remember he played for the Pacers for a while, he bounced around because I followed his career as well, but he never seemed to find his groove until he got picked up by the Bulls, and I was like, oh, is he going to be a bench warmer for the Bulls now? And then he went on to be fucking badass with the Bulls. So I ended up watching the Bulls and paying attention to the Bulls at this period of time when they were the greatest team on the planet.
Uncredited appearance in this movie by Steve Kerr. True story.
Yeah, no, you see him very briefly during one of the Bulls sequences.
Mm-hmm.
During the flashback sequences to back when Michael was a player.
Okay, can we just go, like, not to derail your story here, but
Oh, that was my story. Let's move on. Let's talk about the movie again.
I want to there's something about this movie that from the fucking get-go as we were watching tonight, I was like, oh, it may be a little tough to defend this one. I get that. It's fine. Whatever. There's a lot of nostalgia. There's a lot of rose-colored glasses. A lot of Chicago Bulls red-colored glasses that are going to go on when I talk about this movie. Because from the very beginning, it's 1973, and a young Michael Jordan is outside shooting hoops.
I believe I can fly.
Amazing soundtrack, I will say that.
I can believe unequivocally, I can touch the sky.
An amazing soundtrack this movie has. One of the first CDs I ever bought. Incidentally.
And they played that song only like three times in the movie. None of them.
I could have used three more.
I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky.
None of them really make sense.
I could have used a performance of I Believe I Can Fly as long as Trapped in the Closet.
See,
that's all I'm saying.
The thing is, if you're going to use that song, there's only one moment in the movie you use that song.
When he's actually flying.
When he jumps up to make that, and it's the longest 10 seconds in the history of film.
No, instead, at those moments, we get James Newton Howard doing his best impression of Alan Silvestri throughout the entire course of this movie. Because it sounds almost exactly like the score from Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which I think is on purpose.
It might be.
I think they were like, James, look, we wanted Alan Silvestri because we want to trick people into thinking the animation in this movie that combines animation and real life is as good as that other movie that combined animation and real life 8 years ago that did it a lot better than we did it. So maybe you can just make the incidental music between all the hits from the soundtrack sound a lot like Alan Silvestri, because that's exactly what they do. Anyway, beginning of the movie, young Michael Jordan is plotting out with eerie accuracy the entire trajectory of his life.
Yeah.
He says, Dad, I want to go to the University of North Carolina. I want to play on a championship team. Then I want to play in the NBA. then I'm going to win championships there. Then I'm going to play baseball. Then there's going to be a lot of gambling rumors when I quit basketball. Then I'm going to be an owner. No, he doesn't go that far, but he does go so far as to say, I want to play baseball just like you. Cut from there to a montage, an honest to God title sequence montage that may as well have been called Last Week on Michael Jordan. Who watching this movie doesn't know who Michael Jordan is? You got Michael Jordan specifically because at the time he was the best player in the NBA, and because of his exposure in commercials, TV appearances, there was not a single person, the Dream Team for fuck's sake, there was not a single person on this planet who didn't know who Michael Jordan was. And yet they show us a montage of, oh, and by the way, hey.
Even Rocky had a montage.
Even if you don't know who Michael Jordan is, that little fucking kid just told you everything that was going to happen, and then we see it happen in montage. Here he is playing in North Carolina. Here he is playing with the Bulls. Here he is winning this championship and that championship, and then it ends with him retiring. And I'm just like, that is so unnecessary. We know everyone on the planet knows who Michael Jordan is.
Yeah, no, in fact, that's that of the... Of the problems this movie has, that opening scene is one that I would instantly want to ditch and flip the other way.
It's a little cringeworthy.
No, because what that scene needed to be was it needed to be a little kid struggling and not being able to do it, and his dad giving him reassuring words that if he puts his mind to it, one day he could do anything.
He could have said, "Son, I believe you can fly," and then boom, into the song.
Into the montage.
Why didn't I direct this movie?
Yeah, no, that would be, you know, instead he comes across as a cocky prick, which
which is hard for a 6-year-old to do, but he does it.
He does it.
Which, you know what, is very apropos to Michael Jordan, who would say things to opposing players like, "I'm going to the lane and there's nothing you could do to stop me." Michael Jordan was a cocky bastard.
Oh,
when he played basketball.
If it's one thing Michael Jordan's known for, it's being one of the nicest guys on the planet. In fact, it's one of those running gags. Like anytime on Reddit, somebody asks the question, "What celebrities have you met that are in real life that are dicks?" Michael Jordan always is in the top comments. Like people have terrible stories about running into him.
Yeah,
and it's always heartbreaking. It's like, no, not Michael. No.
One thing to point out about the Looney Tunes in this movie is that they are not voiced by Mel Blanc's son, Noel, who had been doing a lot of Looney Tunes related things at the time. Mel Blanc's son was supposed to do all of the voices, all of the male character voices in this movie, but for some fucking who knows reason, Warner Brothers could not come to a deal with him. They couldn't I'm sorry, you're Warner Brothers. This is an actual honest to goodness Blanc, like the progeny of the person who is responsible for the popularity of these characters in the first place. And you can't close a deal with this guy. Did you spend all of your money on Michael Jordan?
You can't get Blank to sign on the dotted line.
Did you not give him a blank check? No, you did not, because you spent all of your money apparently on Muggsy Bogues. I don't know. There should have been something left over.
I love that Muggsy Bogues is even in the movie. He's one of those great stars of the NBA that's kind of been relatively forgotten.
It's which is sad because he was amazing. But
yes,
I will say this about Muggsy Bogues. Comedically, I think he does the best job in the movie.
He does. No, he's so likable in this movie.
Yeah.
Like everybody else is like, you know, even Charles Barkley is, you know, kind of overrun by him and kind of like, yeah, no, we're not actors. We're sportsmen. Like,
yeah.
they're two very different talents. Like Michael Jordan does a passably good job here.
He does. And I think that probably is just by virtue of the fact that he had had enough cameras pointed at his face when like Nike or McDonald's or Hanes were shooting commercials. Like he knew what it meant to like be on and be performing. Like, I'm not going to go so far as to say he turns in a good performance in this movie, because there are literally insert shots. Like, my favorite moment of the whole movie in terms of summing up Jordan as a performer is that when they start the second half, all of the tune players like put their angriest faces on, and it's like they just cut from one to the other. Then they cut to Michael Jordan, and he's making a face like, "You guys are going to tell me when the camera's on, right? When you're going to say action, right? No, we're done. Okay, print it." Like, just nothing going on in his face. And it's so clearly an insert shot. I'm like, no second take. No second. Six-peat Michael Jordan doesn't want to do a second take. Okay, I guess we'll just leave that shot in. Sure, why not? But I do think Muggsy Bogues does the best job comedically. And there's a great scene where they're all walking through this hospital trying to figure out what's wrong with them. And Muggsy Bogues, unfortunately, has to suffer a few short jokes in this movie. One from actual players just flat out calling him short. And then this visual gag where they're walking through the hospital and the doctor's kind of talking with them and they're not really paying attention. And all of a sudden, they walk through this crossbeam and all of the taller players get whacked in the head and fall over and Muggsy Bogues just keep on walking. So it's literally a visual representation of how short he is. And then there's another one where they cut from Sean Bradley's gangly scarecrow legs hanging over the psychiatrist's couch, immediately crossfade that to Muggsy Bogues, like, really tiny on the couch. So like, there's a couple of visual Muggsy Bogues is really short jokes, in addition to him just flat out at one point being like, at least you guys are still tall. So he has to suffer a lot of that, but he does a really great job with it. And there's even a moment where he says something like, you know, it's just some psychosomatic thing or something to do with the moon or the alignment of the planets, which still to this day is a line that makes me laugh.
No, there are some great little moments in here. That's the thing, is this is not a... This movie's not a turkey.
No.
I don't think it's a bad movie. I think it's a movie with some really amazing moments and some great concepts that that have odd choices in them, like we were talking about earlier. Like the weird thing about not having Blank Sun in there is that so many of the characters sound weird.
Which, you know, oddly enough, the person doing Bugs Bunny is Billy West. So Billy West, who a lot of people will know from Ren and Stimpy and Futurama, is doing the voice of Bugs Bunny, and I think doing a pretty good job. Like, in fact, it took me a few viewings of this, like later on in life, to even recognize that that was Billy West. So I think he does a pretty good job, but I mean, there are some, and actually Maurice LaMarche, who is also on Futurama with Billy West, the one voice he does in this is Pepe Le Pew, so there's a couple of Futurama cast members supplying the voices of the Looney Tunes characters, but you're right, the other characters just sound a little
Daffy
off.
Sounds a little off.
Oh, yeah.
Elmer Fudd, Yosemite Sam just doesn't sound right. Like, it's like just the voices sound a little off, and that's the weird. It's just so weird and incongruous.
Yeah.
Because it's because that's the, you'd think that the visual identifier is all you need, but no, it seems so off. And that's, but it's made even weirder by the fact that so many of these characters are given so little screen time. It's a Looney Tunes movie, and many of the Looney Tunes have one moment, maybe two. You know, the Tasmanian Devil does what? He mops up the court and makes the court spick and span again, and then eats two basketballs, and that's like the extent of him in this movie.
Well, and I think that comes from the fact that they are trying to balance so much in this movie between entertaining the kids and keeping adults interested, because adults or kids probably don't give a shit that Danny Ainge is yelling at Charles Barkley during the course of this movie. Most kids don't give a shit who Danny Ainge is. Most people who are big fans of the NBA don't give a shit who Danny Ainge is. But you put scenes, so they're trying, and like the whole Larry Bird and Bill Murray and Michael Jordan golfing scene, you know, until Bug shows up with a giant magnet, that's strictly for the parents in the audience. I feel like if this movie has one major flaw, it's that they work really hard to try and balance you know, stuff that appeals to kids and stuff that appeals to adults, and don't really walk that line all that well, which leads to things like you're saying, where the Looney Tunes characters don't all get their moments, which I think is actually better served in a movie like, and this is a very unappreciated movie in my opinion, Looney Tunes Back in Action, where those Looney Tunes characters get their moments they play that really well.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because Who Framed Roger Rabbit, many of these characters get better moments than they do in their own fucking movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of crazy. But what moments there are some great ones. Like I was saying, that second half where they become the Harlem Globetrotters and they're putting explosives on everything.
Yeah.
And they're using gimmicks. The thing is, I think there should have been more of that. You know, they're talking about there being a Space Jam 2 or a Space Jam remake.
Okay, this is the most accidentally serendipitous thing, the kismet of this show, is that we had decided to do this movie for this episode a couple weeks ago before they even confirmed that LeBron James was going to be starring in a sequel to Space Jam, which, by the way, is a great idea. And everybody was so pissed off about it. And I'm like, two things. One, you can't ruin Space Jam.
No.
Okay, as much as I enjoy it, as much as you enjoy it, this is not a a film that is canon. This is not a film that is such a classic that is going to be marred if anyone else attempts what one-time feature film director Joe Pitka did in 1996.
Twice. He
oh, you're right.
Let It Ride.
I'm sorry. He did two feature films, this one being the last. So, yeah, I don't feel like they're going to ruin Space Jam. And two, if you saw the movie Trainwreck, LeBron James actually does comedy pretty well.
Yeah.
Way better than Michael Jordan. Like, that's the one area, LeBron, that I will admit you're better than Jordan. The one. So, yeah, I'm kind of excited about a new... And the other thing is, I'm excited about it because where have the Looney Tunes been since Back in Action?
They couldn't get anything great off the ground.
There was like a CG animated show on Cartoon Network for a while that I thought was terrible, and that's it. Like, that's where the Looney Tunes have been relegated since Back in Action.
Well, what I'm really excited about is I'm excited to hear what movie LeBron James gets traded to.
Oh! Maybe he'll be in not one, not two, not three, not four, but five different movies before they make Space Jam 2.
Yeah, yeah, and then at the last minute, he'll get traded back.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'll be like, this is the movie I wanted to make all along.
See, but that's something great that they could do.
I'm never leaving Space Jam. Those are the words I want to hear come out of his mouth.
I will never leave Moron Mountain. I'm going to take my talents to Looney Tunes. No, but see, that's something they could totally make fun of. And if that Space Jam follows the model of this Space Jam, oh, yeah. LeBron James will make fun of himself in that movie, and it will be glorious. It'll be fantastic. I am all about that.
Yeah,
so,
and
100%.
If they just keep in mind, the point of the movie is the basketball game.
Yes.
If less than half the movie is not the basketball game.
Yeah.
You know, is the basketball game, that you have failed. You need this. Most of this game needs to be the basketball game, and it needs to be Harlem Globetrotters. Go watch a couple of Harlem Globetrotters games and be like, what would the Harlem Globetrotters be doing if they were actual Looney Tunes?
Throwing giant buckets of glitter. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, probably so.
Maybe. But yeah, that's what this movie that's what that movie needs.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I think making a sequel to it or remaking it is absolutely apt, and I think it's a great idea because there is a lot here to mine, and this is the perfect movie to remake. I don't think they need to make a sequel, but I mean they can. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like you call it. I mean, if they do call it Space Jam 2, it's just like they come back and they've got to play
just like
again.
Independence Day.
Just like Independence
Day. You had 20 years to prepare for the return of the Monstars. What have you been doing to prepare?
There's the slogan of the poster.
We had 20 years to prepare for their return. Our technology has... Thank God, by the way, the technology will have advanced by then because, again, I love this movie, but to not acknowledge how bad the effects are in this...
The animation and the effects in this movie are kind of... It's in that weird period when they were experimenting with using CG to augment.
Yeah.
And Disney had done it with a few sequences in some of their movies, but had not given over fully to it yet.
When you got Spielberg money and you got Zemeckis directing, as in Roger Rabbit, yeah. Looks great, looks amazing, groundbreaking stuff. When you have a music video director on his second film, Joe Pitka, and you just have Ivan Reitman producing, and Warner Brothers is too cheap to even get the son of the creator of the voices of all their Looney Tunes to come back, yeah, I'm thinking all the money on this probably went to the basketball players. Probably, like, signing bonus. He's probably the only actor to have a signing bonus would be Michael Jordan. But, so the effects. And there's so many moments where you can tell they're working in the most confined green screen space because they try to move the camera more, like as if Michael Jordan is doing more movement around the room when he's basically, like, you know, to crib from basketball terms, planting his pivot foot and saying, this is the area I can operate in because this is entirely green around me, and there's no fluid interaction between him and the animated characters. It just, you can tell from a mile away that someone's on a soundstage and someone's being inserted in digitally after the fact.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because, again, 6 years earlier.
And the animation style, the choice.
8 years earlier.
The choice is so weird. It's very, like, bright and glary and blown out.
Yeah.
In a very weird way. Like, there isn't another film I can think of that looks this way. It's almost like they took the ideas of Roger Rabbit and added a little CG splash to it.
Yeah.
Like, it's very strange. Again, this movie is just riddled with weird choices. and weird choices wrapped around ultimately an entertaining film.
A very entertaining movie, and one that has, I just want to hit on this one more time, an absolutely phenomenal soundtrack. I think that there's a lot you can forgive about a movie if it's entertaining and if it has a good soundtrack. And this movie's soundtrack, again, was one of the first CDs I ever bought. And it's anchored, of course, by R. Kelly's I Believe I Can Fly, back before we knew what a giant creep R. Kelly was. Again, time capsule movie. That's what we're dealing with here. It also has...
I want you to undo my fly.
Yeah, see, thankfully, he didn't redo this one. But the Quad City DJs doing the actual song Space Jam, I don't care who you are, that is, you know what, as a 12-year-old, that was my Mortal Kombat song. That was the song that every time it was on, I was like, oh yeah, I'm excited for this. I don't care what it is, let's do it, I am pumped. Everybody get up, it's time to slam now.
Who doesn't love the Quad City DJs?
Well, the world, but that's not the point. Because after this and Come On Ride the Train, I think everybody kind of gave up on them. They became the Tri-City DJs for a while, and then the Dual City DJs, and then they broke up, unfortunately. But on top of that, you have a great cover of...
Mono City DJs.
Mono City DJs.
They stay at home sick.
Yeah, they stay at home, but you get 2 weeks out of school. That's kind of cool. Fly Like an Eagle cover by Seal, which is actually really good.
That is actually a really good cover.
And you know this movie is super 90s, when you have an appearance on the soundtrack by, ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for the Spin Doctors doing a cover of Casey and the Sunshine Band's That's the Way I Like It. Hit 'em High, the Monstars Anthem by, I shit you not, Busta Rhymes, Coolio, LL Cool J, Method Man, and Be Real. All of those guys on one track doing that. I hit 'em high, hit 'em high, hit 'em high. So fucking good. God, this soundtrack is amazing. It makes me excited. Oh, and of course, it's 90s, so CNC Music Factory has to be on there, of course.
Yeah.
And Technotronic. CNC Music Factory and Technotronic.
Yeah, but those were songs that were staples at games.
It's kind of like Jock Jams incorporated into the Space Jam soundtrack.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah, no, that's true. And then there's another cover of...
Technotronic, they started as a club band that was really, you know, all the club kids were into, and eventually became like cheesy NBA music. Like, it's so weird to listen to and think, oh yeah, no, I remember going to a rave and dancing to that at one point, and now it's what everybody at the arena like enters to now. Like, it's right? Very strange.
It is very strange. And another cover that's on the soundtrack is Salt-N-Pepa doing a cover.
No, that is not their name.
I'm sorry, Salt-N-Pepa.
Thank you.
Doing a cover of Upside Down, which is an old disco hit.
Oh yeah.
So like, there's great covers on this. There's great original songs on this. There's like jock jammy stuff to get you pumped up.
There's the Spin Doctors, because we're not going to incorporate that into the word great anywhere.
No. No, and I was actually, this is a humiliating thing to admit, but I was a big fan of the Spin Doctors as a kid, both of their hits.
Come on, everybody loved the Spin Doctors for 10 minutes.
I bought their greatest hit album. That's how devoted to them I was.
It had one song on each side.
Yeah, and it was the same song. It was weird.
But they had two.
They did. They
princes.
Had two princes and Little Miss Can't Be Wrong. Why do I know that off the top of my head? God damn it, this is horrible.
It really is.
Oh, that's humiliating. But the other thing I really love about this movie is a few years ago I was watching it and something dawned on me that completely changed my perspective on this film.
Was it why Marvin the Martian wasn't playing and was reffing?
Perhaps. No, it was the fact that Space Jam, we've covered movies in the past on this show that have been sort of their own interpretation of one of the greatest films ever made, Akira Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai. Most specifically, we covered Battle Beyond the Stars. It struck me watching this movie, this is the Looney Tunes / NBA version of The Seven Samurai. This is a story about a group of mercenaries who come down to this peaceful little village, in this case the Looney Tunes world, and seek to enslave the people there to do their bidding. So, forced into an arena of battle for which they have no experience whatsoever, they are forced to go out and hire someone to basically do their fighting for them. So you basically replace Seven Samurai with one almost 7-foot-tall NBA star, and you have the basic structure of this show. of this movie. And not only that, but you have a character in Wayne Knight doing probably the worst Wayne Knight movie of the 90s, which is the worst Wayne Knight movie of the 90s.
My favorite Martian in the 90s. I would say maybe Pros and Cons, but like I don't think anyone but me ever saw Pros and Cons. It may have been a direct-to-video movie, and I only know it because it showed up in my video store.
Interesting.
So that may not really count. Like that might be one of those movies that's like, that never saw it theatrical.
Well, the thing
my
is,
favorite Martian is definitely...
is no one's favorite anything. But he is basically... this movie's analog to the character of Kikuchiyo in Seven Samurai, who is this clownish, irritating character, and the other samurai keep trying to get rid of him. And, you know, every time Wayne Knight appears and gives one of his lead balloon joke deliveries, you're going to want to get rid of him too, or at least want him to commit harakiri. So, and there's also there's a theme in Seven Samurai where the central female character is the farmer's daughter, and she's dressed up to look like a boy because she wants to, you know, that she wants to take part in the battle. And in Space Jam, Lola Bunny, who is created for this movie, did not exist in the Looney Tunes universe before this movie.
Well, somebody, it was Natalie Dormer traveling back in time playing Bunny.
Right? Is that still the rumor that
Natalie Dormer went back in time
and played Lola Bunny?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, okay. Lola Bunny is similarly dealing with these gender roles issues because she's probably the best player on the team of the Looney Tunes outside of Michael Jordan, but everyone keeps calling her doll, and she's like has to fight up against that. Like there are all these like weird little parallels between Seven Samurai and Space Jam that I know people are like, get the guys in white jackets and haul Brian Salisbury off of this podcast because there's no way in hell that Space Jam has any correlation whatsoever to Seven Samurai. It's not true. And in fact, there's a lot of, there's this central, like thematic, there's this theme in both movies, in Seven Samurai about honor and the pitfalls of class systems and all this stuff. And if you look at what happens to the athletes after they lose their talents, like they're not just run out of the league. They like lose all respect in the community and become like pariahs to the point that you're just like, wow, I guess if you're not a professional athlete, you're kind of nothing in the universe that this movie is creating. So there's just a lot of like really weird little similarities. Like back when this podcast was a written column, I wrote an entire basic thesis about how Space Jam is Looney Tunes and Michael Jordan doing Seven Samurai. And even in this viewing, I was like, yep, this is something interesting that keeps me engaged in this movie. Imagining that it somehow draws its inspiration from Akira Kurosawa, because why the hell not?
That's so much deeper than the Marvin the Martian thing.
But why is Marvin? You know why?
There's an answer.
What is the answer?
Why is Marvin the Martian not playing and why is he reffing?
I don't know.
Because he is the only character in the movie who is both an alien and a Looney Tune.
Ah, which is why the original Nike ad that this is based on had Michael Jordan, Bugs Bunny playing against Marvin the Martian and some aliens. So again, for those of you playing at home, this movie is either an homage to one of the greatest films of all time, Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, or just the product of two very successful separate ad campaigns featuring Bill Murray and Michael Jordan, the Looney Tunes. Take your pick, guys. The options are all out there. The buffet, the table is set. You sit wherever you like. But yeah, that's just something that makes me enjoy this movie a little bit more. It's just kind of imagining that it's based on the Seven Samurai. One thing that is really weird about this movie, though, is that Michael Jordan, his whole family is played by actors.
It's kind of weird.
It's bizarre. Like, I understand his dad at the beginning being played by an actor because his dad had passed on. But, like, his wife is played by actress Teresa Randall. All of his kids are played by actors, even though they are given the names in the movie of his actual kids. It's just, what, if you're gonna have Sean Bradley delivering all of his own lines, why can't Marcus and Jasmine and Jeffrey Jordan be in the movie delivering their own lines? It's an odd choice.
It is an odd choice, but at the same time, you know, acting isn't easy. Acting is hard.
That's true.
You know, everybody thinks, oh, I could be an actor until the camera points at you.
As illustrated by a couple of the shots of this, of Michael Jordan going, what, is the camera on me? Oh, okay. My bad.
Wait, I'm not wearing Hanes. Why am I, this is the other thing.
That's another great poking fun at himself moment. in this movie when Wayne Knight, who plays the publicist for the baseball team, says, all right, it's time to go to the game, so put on your Hanes, lace up your Nikes, eat your Wheaties, and we'll grab a Big Mac on the way to the ballpark. It's all brands that Michael Jordan has actually endorsed. So you would think he would be used to this by now. Is, hey, the camera's on you, so go. But anyway, yeah, no real Jordans in this movie other than Michael himself. And then, of course, it ends with the big, again, the time capsule thing.
Yeah.
Ends with this big dramatic, Michael Jordan comes back to the Bulls sporting number 45 because, anyone, they had already retired his number.
Yep.
It's like, dude, we just retired. You're going to have to play with a different number now, okay? And then the next season, they actually gave him back number 23. So it's like, in case of emergency, break glass above the stadium and take the jersey back and just let Michael Jordan play until he retires again and then comes back with the Wizards and is now the owner of the new Charlotte Hornets. Yeah. Again, time capsules. Just all kinds of little things about this movie that date it impossibly. And one of the other things, we mentioned this a little bit before, is how many of the players featured in the movie are now GMs, presidents, guys in the owner's boxes.
Oh, yeah.
Vlade Divac is featured. He's now the president of operations for the Sacramento Kings, I believe. Larry Bird is now president of operations for the Indiana Pacers. We mentioned Steve Kerr is the coach of the Golden State Warriors. Michael Jordan is the owner of the Charlotte Hornets. So a lot of these guys are, and Patrick Ewing is actually still trying to get a head coaching job to this day in the
Muggsy
NBA.
Is still short.
Muggsy is still short and just eating out for days on that joke. But yeah, and that's the other thing is, Bill Murray showing up in the second half of this game is kind of a saving grace for movie, because even that game, as fun as it is, starts to drag on a little bit, especially after the very bizarre, like, let's try and get into the mindset of selling this movie to children using professional athletes as your stars. During halftime, Bugs concocts this great idea to basically placebo effect the entire team by convincing them that he has a bottle of something called Mike's Secret Stuff. And if you drink Mike's Secret Stuff, you immediately get stronger, you get faster, you get better at basketball. And he and Michael encourage the entire team
to juice!
They're halfway through their very first basketball game ever, and Michael Jordan, literally at one point, Daffy Duck says, you know, this goes against everything they taught us in health class. And Michael Jordan literally says to him, do you want to win or not? And at that point, I was like, okay, wait.
Where's the shot of Daffy Duck bending over and taking the needle in the ass?
Right?
Like, that's what we need right now.
And I'm like, this is going to be an after-school special, right? Like, they're all going to have roid rage and, like, be fighting each other. They're going to be crying in the shower. And then it's going to be like, we want the game to be pure. We're not going to take this anymore. No, it's all just this bullshit placebo effect to make them think that they're going to win. But it's like, it really does feel like a juicing storyline.
It's
in the middle of the Space Jam movie.
And then they even go so far as that the magic was inside you all along.
No, the magic was inside this basketball. There's actual magic in this movie.
Yeah.
Turns out you guys just suck. Yeah. Turns out you guys just suck. I'm good at basketball, and the real magic's in that ball with all the NBA talent.
Yeah. And oh yeah, the budget for this was really small, so we can only tell Michael Jordan that he can break the laws of physics in the last 10 seconds of the game.
Yeah, that's pretty hilarious. They're like, first of all, Michael Jordan observes all this shit. I don't think, okay, the character of Michael Jordan, not the actor, but the character of Michael Jordan in this movie, I don't think he fully grasps what's happening at any point during the movie. Because he says that, where he says, like, oh, last 10 seconds of the game, now you tell me we can do all this? I'm like, you've been watching people do this. You've been watching all these characters
but
do
not
this.
People. He's been watching animated.
He's been
characters.
Folded up into a ball and bounced around a court before the game
that
even started. He knows exactly the physics mean nothing in this game. Otherwise, he would have gotten up from that ball and been like, what the fuck just happened to me? How am I not dead? Why are my ribs not broken? But no, he's just like, oh, I'm going to shake that off. So he knows that. And also, at one point during the game, he tells Swackhammer, like, hey, let's raise the stakes. If you win, you get me. And he's like, you'll be our slave and you'll be the star attraction. He's just like, yeah, okay. And it's like, dude, you have just basically offered yourself into slavery if you don't win this game. And not only that, but at the beginning of the game, where the Looney Tunes are all going to be slaves if they lose, Michael Jordan says to them, hey, guys, let's just go out there and have some fun. I'm like, no, motherfucker, we're playing for our very lives here. Let's, like, maybe not just go out there and have a good time, but maybe actually really try to win this one.
I feel like that's how General Lee pitched it to the South. You know what?
Let's just go have some fun.
Let's go have some fun. Like, whether we end up with slaves at the end of it, let's just have a clean fight. Let's get it on.
Let's literally go have fun with the Washington generals that we're facing. Oh my God, the parallels to the Civil War just became apparent as well. Terrifying, but possibly true. One other thing I wanted to mention about this movie is Chuck Jones, who of course is one of the most famous animators of, you know, the Looney Tunes, and was one of the guys instrumental in its success. Do you know what his biggest criticism of this movie was?
No.
His biggest criticism of this movie, and this is so beautiful in such a weird, bizarre way, is that he felt that it strayed too far from the source material because Bugs would never openly recruit others to fight his battles for him. He thought the biggest problem with this movie is that Bugs Bunny didn't outwit and outplay all of the Monstars on his own.
He's not wrong.
He's like
that is fundamentally so Bugs Bunny's biggest strength and flaw is that he cannot let it go. Like you're right. He too easily, I had never thought about that, but yeah, he too easily gives in. That's why he doesn't feel like Bugs Bunny.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if we go back to the example of that baseball cartoon where he literally plays all the positions, maybe that's what Chuck Jones expected him to do in this. But it's like, I don't think you can stretch that out for 90 minutes. I think that works great for a 3-minute cartoon. Not sure as a 90-minute movie that would really hold water.
No. What you do in that movie is...
So now we're rewriting Space Jam. So if you're listening, if you happen to be one of the people handling the sequel, give us a call. Come on, or at least give me a call. I'll fucking do that all day.
Yeah. It's what you do is Bugs Bunny tries that, and he does that's essentially kind of the first act of the movie is him trying to outwit the Monstars, and he cannot. He just doesn't have it in him. And he gets convinced that he has to get help, and he cannot. This is the one fight he can't do on its own. And so Bugs Bunny's like, well, if I can't do it, I need the greatest, you know, forces on the planet. I need the greatest player of all time.
Toshiro MJ. Yeah.
And that's where he has to go down broken, and he hates doing it. And you build that up with him and Daffy, where you have moments where, you know, he and Daffy are confiding, like these private moments where it's like, this isn't who I am. And he's like, you have to understand, you know. You don't know what it's like to lose all the time. Yeah. You don't know what it's like to need help from other people. Sometimes you need to have help. Sometimes you cannot do everything alone.
Sometimes you need Pippin. Sometimes you need Horace Grant, and you have to admit that.
Yeah. And so he, and that becomes Bugs Bunny's arc, is learning to accept help, something he's never been able to do in the history of being a Looney Tunes. So you do that angle of it, you preserve who he is, and you grow Bugs Bunny. And then you have moments where he lashes out against it, where he absolutely has to just taunt the other players, and he absolutely cannot resist being the center of attention and fucking with everybody.
Yeah.
And that's the Bugs Bunny we love.
Yeah, and the whole time, just... And I think he actually does this in the movie, which I think is true to Bugs Bunny. He's never taking anything seriously. Like, because he's Bugs Bunny, he's never going to take anything seriously. What I don't understand is, again, why Jordan doesn't... Like, maybe this is because of what we just talked about there's some parallels between those two characters, where Michael Jordan had to start relying on his team and couldn't do it all by himself. And Bugs Bunny, so the two of them, that parallel is that Jordan was like, oh, if he's not taking this seriously, I guess I won't either, even though I've literally just offered myself up into indentured servitude if we don't win this game, and I'm still of the, oh, let's just go out there and have some fun mode. So, I don't know. Maybe that's what it is, but I want to point out a couple other little things that make this movie such an indelible little time capsule. One is there's a line where Larry Johnson says, man, when they lose their talent, man, my grandmother could play better than us, which of course is based on the popular series of commercials at the time featuring Larry Johnson as Grandmama, as his own grandmother. And then there's something that was cut out of the script that if 12-year-old Brian had seen this shit in the movie, would have made this the greatest film of all time. Apparently, in an original draft of the script, there was a scene where the Toon Squad was going to run afoul of MC Scat Cat and the Stray Mob, which was an animated hip-hop group who worked with Paula Abdul.
Oh, yeah.
In such great musical achievements as Opposites Attract, which I literally heard on the radio the other day and had to listen to the whole fucking song. I loved that song as a kid. I loved that video as a kid. There was cartoons. There was Paula Abdul. Like, it had pretty much everything I wanted in a music video. So,
two steps forward and one step back.
We come together because I'm bullshit's attracting, you know. It ain't fiction, just a natural fact. Okay, yeah, I'll do the whole song. I fucking love that song. So the fact that there was almost a scene where the Looney Tunes and a just freshly retired Michael Jordan run into MC Scat Cat and the Stray Mob would have been the most 90s thing of all time. Like, boom, just a giant rubber stamp should have hit the screen and said 90s at that point. Spin Doctors on the soundtrack, Salt and Peppa on the soundtrack. Come on, guys. This may be one of the most 90s movies ever made. Depending on how you... A Pulp Fiction reference, for fuck's sake. Come on. There aren't even that many references to other movies in this movie.
No. There's not. Like, that's what sticks out like a sore thumb here. Like, it feels like one of those studio note afterthoughts.
Like, somebody was happened to be doing blow with Quentin Tarantino. I was like, what are you working on? Space Jam? You know, be great. You know, be like really, 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 really great. Is if you just put a Pulp Fiction reference in there, and they're like, well, that doesn't really fit. It's like, you should do it. It'd be great. And then they just did it. It's probably like this. Some producer was coke buddies with Quentin Tarantino.
Oh no, I don't think it. No. I think it was something more along the lines of we need something to connect with audiences. We need a joke for the adults at this point. Like, what can we reference? Like, it's 1996. Like, what else has happened? Like, at this point. You know, 96, importantly, was the beginning of kind of new Hollywood, where we just started to get big blockbusters again. And this is where nerd blockbusters started to become a thing. Because up until this point, indie movies were the only thing of real, you know, worth in that era. Like, everything had kind of bottomed out. So there weren't, you know, this came out the same year that, as we were just discussing, Independence Day came out, so they couldn't make an Independence Day reference, and nobody really, you know, Michael Bay had only made one movie at that point, and it hadn't done well with Bad Boys, and so, you know, where do you go? Oh, well, hey, let's make a Pulp Fiction reference. It's one of the biggest movies in the world.
Well, you know what? I just realized what else hadn't come out yet was maybe it had just come out, so it would have been too close to release. Is Scream?
Yeah.
Which was a very big kickoff for like the meta film movement at the time. So, yeah, Pulp Fiction may have been the most meta movie that had been out at the time.
Yeah, it was the most big relevant thing in the era. So I get why they referenced it, but it's still fucking weird that they did. What are you doing referencing an R-rated movie in a fucking kids movie? Like, that just, like, I mean, it's. It probably didn't seem too weird at the time. It's just much weirder now. Like, you know, you and I have talked about in the past the weirdness of growing up in the 80s and just some of the strange things that, you know, we had a Rambo cartoon show. We had Rambo action figures. You know, I had an action figure of a damaged Vietnam vet from that first showed up in First Blood.
Nothing is over.
There was a Toxic Avenger cartoon show and video game.
Yeah, what the fuck,
man?
There
was a RoboCop cartoon show
and
video game.
What the fuck, man?
Like, RoboCop. Yeah. Toxic Avenger, like these bloody, gory, violent films had kid shows. So it didn't seem too weird in 96 to make a Pulp Fiction reference, because Pulp Fiction was everywhere at the time.
This is true.
But it's still fucking weird looking back on it.
Yeah, and that is kind of the experience of watching this whole movie. There's a lot of things that you look back on and you're like, that's really just it's bizarre that this movie exists.
Yeah.
And that's all, like, take away the nostalgic element, take away the fact that I'm one of those people who's a giant geek and a giant sports fan. Take all that out of this. I am just really obsessed with movies that should not be. And Space Jam, combining Looney Tunes and the NBA is a thing, and making references to adult grown-up movies, like
Ron Jeremy here playing for the Toons.
Ew. This is a thing that should not exist.
Make things grow.
Much like what Cargill is saying right now, these are things that should not be.
They should not be.
And yet, when it all comes together, it's a it's an impossibly charming movie. It's very entertaining. There are moments like almost every one of Daffy Duck's fourth wall breaking Deadpool moments are really good, where he says things like, you know, hey, Bugs, all those like lunchboxes and T-shirts with our faces on them, do you ever see any money from all that? No. Well, we need new agents because we're getting hosed. So, like, there's a lot of, like, little Warner Brothers in-jokes that Daffy does that I think are really solid. I think you're right. Once they get to the actual game, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had there. Bill Murray is his most excellent Bill Murray-ness. And, yeah, so there's a lot to like about this movie despite the fact that it definitely has some major, major flaws. Like, as a film, this is more like Jordan with the Wizards. But as on entertainment level, this is, like, Jordan 96 for sure. Like this is the year that this came out. This is that Jordan, like really top of his game, and just baffled people when he retired because he was still going so strong, which he proved when he came back and won more championships. So yeah, that's Space Jam, and it will always be a movie that I love. It'll always be a soundtrack I love listening to. I still have
I believe I can fly,
I believe I can touch the sky. I think about this movie every night and day. And
you have Space Jam action figures in your bedroom.
I do. My girlfriend actually bought me, still in the box, the last one I didn't have. It was like the perfect gift ever. Excellent, excellent nostalgic movie. Well, it's excellent nostalgia. I don't know if I would really call it an excellent movie. So much fun. Guys, you've probably at least heard of Space Jam. If you haven't watched it, go do it. Go do it immediately.
Duck.
Yeah.
You kick it in here.
You go to the hole.
Bill.
And dominate.
We own defense.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa. I don't play defense.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which when I kept thinking about this theme of two things that shouldn't go together, that make something really weird that really shouldn't exist, but somehow people are drawn to. I'm going to go with the Doritos Locos Taco, because two things that should not go together are Cool Ranch Doritos and tacos from Taco Bell. And yet somebody decided that was a good idea, and Bob's your uncle. We have the Space Jam of late night snack foods.
Is that still around?
I believe it still is.
I've never had one.
And much like Space Jam, doesn't have much of a shelf life, the Doritos Locos Taco. So, yeah, it's definitely a time capsule of excess, the Doritos Locos Taco. I can't even bring myself to think about it. Like, I'm getting ulcers.
How many have you eaten?
Two. Only two, and just thinking about it gives me ulcers, so...
Is it delicious?
No, it tastes like shame. It tastes like shame.
Wait, it tastes like Michael Fassbender naked? Like that's...
Yes, it tastes like Michael Fassbender naked with a possible subplot about sibling incest. That's exactly what the Doritos Locos Taco tastes like. I've said that so many times, guys. I've posted all over the Taco Bell Reddit forums about how... eating a Doritos Locos Taco is basically like having Michael Fassbender's dick shoved in your face.
For an hour and a half.
Hey, speaking of dicks in your face for over an hour, that's been Junk Food Cinema!
Yay!
Hope you've enjoyed the jam. We hope that you will believe that you can fly into our next episode. We have come to slam, guys, and we are going to slam your ear holes with all of our back catalog episodes via iTunes and Stitcher.
And slam evil.
And we're going to slam evil as well. And you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or at facebook.com/massaworm.
All right. And you can find me online on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury, or on Facebook. My Facebook page is facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. And yeah, I'm just going to close out this show. You know what? I'm not even going to say anything, because I'm going to let the Quad City DJs take us out with their dulcet tones and expressing something that I think is every bit as true now as it was in 1996.
So. And this is the actual Quad City DJs. We found them down at the gas station.
Yes, we did. They were eating Doritos Locos Tacos, actually. So exit the jam.
Hey, DJ, turn it up.